Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Hey, Sound Opinions listeners, if you support us on Patreon, you get to listen to our podcast ad-free on Patreon.
One, two, tres, cuatro.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we're talking with Janet Bean and Rick Rizzo of 11th Dream Day. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. We'll look back over the band's 40 years of music, but first, some new music from Wednesday and Lancum.
That is a little bit of a song called Turkey Vultures from the new album by Wednesday. And Greg, I love this title, Rat Saw God. Who is Wednesday? This is a group from Asheville, North Carolina, on the very hip indie label Dead Oceans, revolving around vocalist Carly Hartzman. She apparently was attending college in Asheville and saw Mitski's Tiny Desk concert on NPR and said, "I've got to start playing guitar." The band has been going for some time now. I think one of the keys to understanding it is the covers album it released in 2022, Mowing the Leaves Instead of Piling Them Up, which featured covers by, Chris Bell and Drive-By Truckers, by the Smashing Pumpkins and Vic Chestnut. A little country, a little shoegaze psychedelic noise, not to tip my hand in the review. This album, the fifth in its career, is garnering the most attention by far that Wednesday has so far received. Let's play a track from it and we'll give our reviews. This is a song called Bull Believer, or a little part of it, because it's an 8.5-minute epic. Bull Believer by Wednesday from Rat Saw God.
That is Bull Believer from the new Wednesday record, Rat Saw God.
I just love that title.
Early on in the record, you get 8 minutes of pure confrontation. You know, I was thinking when I was listening to this track, and I'm just going, what the hell is this? It's just like getting hit between the eyes with a rock.
Those screams from Carly Hartzman, man, you'd have to go back to like Courtney Love in her heyday.
Well, I'm thinking like those Yoko Ono records that were reviled back in the day and now look almost futuristic, like predicting what would happen years later. And I was thinking about this whole idea of confrontation, Jim, is that that seems to be a lost art in rock.
Mm-hmm.
You know, guitar-based rock bands. Who's doing the real confrontation where you kind of have to, you either love it or you absolutely hate it, but there's no middle ground on this. And they basically stake out their turf here. To me, what pulled me in about that track, and I think the context is important because the rest of the album isn't quite in that vein, but it's still pretty damn great.
Yeah.
You know, not only is Hartzman a terrific songwriter and guitarist and confrontational vocalist, you've got a great band. The mix of the shoegaze, overpowering blast furnace guitars, plus that pedal steel bringing this country element into it.
Yeah, that twang.
That's an interesting combination of influences that they're bringing together. But Hartzman, in that song, what is she screaming about? She's screaming over and over again, finish him, finish him.
Mm.
And she's quoting from a video game that this guy on a couch is playing while she's observing him on the stairs with this bloody nose, like her nose, you know. So she's hurt, in pain, and this guy is completely oblivious to her, you know. And I get that whole scenario, some 20-plus-year-old guy fixated on his video game, and she's going, finish him! And
he's blasting away killing people
it's
in
Mortal
the video
Kombat.
Universe.
Yeah, and that's one of the buzzwords. And it's a fascinating little detail. When I'm listening to her lyrics, I'm thinking of a photography of Diane Arbus.
Ooh.
Where she's talking about these marginally in tremendous detail and almost lovingly portraying these marginalized figures in society. Her lyrics remind me of those photos. She's talking about really marginalized people in almost all of these songs. And some of the lyrical detail is really stunning. So I think she's become one of those writers that is literary, almost literary, or photographic, if you prefer, in terms of the way she's chronicling a part of this world. The Klutz brothers' parents fight in the yard in their underwear. You know, Bobby and Jimmy sit in the baby pool with lice in their hair. I mean, it's not like this attractive scene, but she's not judging these people.
No,
you know?
No, she's one of them.
She's basically telling us, this is the world that I grew up in and around. Down on these people at all. Rat Saw God, you mentioned that title. It's kind of confrontational too. But I think the whole hit thing there is we can find the divine in the worst of places.
Yeah, yeah. No, you know, there's an almost Southern Gothic feel
to a lot
of what she is doing. But the novelistic eye, Greg, you say Diane Arbus. I say more like Flannery O'Connor something.
Same thing.
And making fun of a neighbor next door who's America's spoiled child. But, you know, he gives out full-size candy bars on Halloween.
Yeah.
It's just like, wow. And I can't recall in my deep love of shoegaze, what elevates just a moderately okay shoegaze band to a great one is the rhythm section.
Mm-hmm.
And we have an extraordinary rhythm section in this five-piece band. You know, they can range in dynamics from whisper quiet to just full-on rage, completely backing Carly's screaming delivery. And, you know, I've just never seen anybody bring to psychedelic rock as much of a weird country perspective. I love it. You know, there's a fine line between Carter Family yodeling and psychedelia. It maybe not that fine a line. Anyway, Wednesday's obliterated it.
On the 4th of March, we did set sail, all on the sweet and a pleasant gale, with
hearts undaunted, we set for sea, bound for New York in America. Our cruel captain, as we did find, left half of our provisions behind. Our cruel captain, you'll understand, meant to starve us all before we reached the
That is a bit of a song called The New York Traitor from the new Lancome LP, False Lancome, the fourth album from this Irish quartet. Long story short, this is an Irish quartet that's refreshing centuries-old Irish music for the 21st century and beyond. They are part of a community of mostly Dublin-based artists and bands blending original songs with covers of songs that sometimes are centuries old, mixing folk, country, indie rock, avant-garde, especially avant-garde with these guys. Others in that scene, Lisa O'Neill, she's getting a lot of buzz as well. There's this harmonizing brother act called Ye Vagabonds who opened shows for Phoebe Bridgers last summer. There's the singer-songwriter John Francis Flynn, and then you've got these guys. This scene started getting attention from a person that we respect greatly, Jeff Travis of Rough Trade Records. He signed these guys. He signed Lisa O'Neill. Started an offshoot label to sort of highlight what they've done. Travis has got a hell of a track record. The Raincoats, The Smiths, Goat Girl currently, Anal and Sniffers, Parquet Courts. He's signed some amazing bands.
He's got ears,
Lancome is in that... in that house now. Their 2019 album was the big breakthrough, The Live Long Day, the third album, and now they've got the follow-up called False Lancome. Here's a track from it before we review it. Go Dig My Grave is the name of the song, from Lancome on Sound Opinions.
Go dig my grave.
Go Dig My Grave, the opening track on False Lancome by the Irish Dublin-based group Lancome. All right, Greg, I'm going to preface this by saying I am one quarter Irish, okay? My grandfather, Hanley, made the trek from the motherland to the U.S., helped dig the Lincoln Tunnel, okay? Irish laborer. But there's Irish artistry, and then there's Dye the River Green and Puke Up Your Green Beer on St. Patrick's Day, Chicago Irish. I got a whiff of that vomit on the streets.
Really?
Yeah, you know, I love Go Dig My Grave. Opens the album, 8.5 minutes. I love The Turn, almost 13 minutes. Closes the album.
When this song is over, when this song is dead, they'll pick apart the notions that rattle in your head.
The idea of connecting the dots between the timeless Celtic drones of Irish folk music and modern psychedelia, it's right up there with Spiritualized. Right? I've been thinking a lot about the way Spiritualized brought in blues and gospel into psychedelia. I think that's Lancome at its best, is doing that with traditional Irish folk music. But now look, we are in Chicago, okay? A lot of the tracks, like the one you bumped in with, The New York Traitor, The Captain Was a Murderer. Oh, man. All right. You know, and the pipes, the Irish pipes on Master Crowley's just drive me crazy. Sometimes they're way too trad and not bringing anything new to it. I think of that band from Chicago, The Drovers. I think of a band 25 years ago in Minneapolis, Boiled in Lead. I think both of those groups were bringing in more contemporary and avant-garde touches to their traditional Irish music. You know, at times, I think of what I said to a student who was enamored enough of Mumford & Sons to get the lyrics to one entire song tattooed up and down her arm. It's like, go listen to Fairport Convention, and then you're going to feel bad about getting that tattoo, all right? I'm just saying. I wish this whole album was as good as that opening and closing track.
Well, you know, the fact that you're talking about gimmicks and Green River Irish trad, you know, kind of gimmick bands, I don't see that connection at all. I think these guys are the real deal in terms of the kind of influences they're using. I mean, to me, an apt comparison might be the Pogues. There was a lot of traditional elements in the Pogues, but yeah, the songwriting and also the treatment of the instrumentation brought it forward. To my mind, when we talk about great vocalists, the singer, Rady Peat in this group is just outstanding voiced. You know, she's got this almost ancient quality to her voice, like you could have heard it three centuries ago, and yet some of that edge of like a PJ Harvey or an Anna Calvi that I love.
I wish there was more of that edge.
you know, I got to say, the Live Long Day, the previous album was more in that vein than this one. This is a little bit more straight ahead in some instances. But I still think it's an incredibly strong record. I am blown away by, you know, you mentioned the New York Trader. I love the fact that they have this punky aggression with an accordion in there. You know, that song, Netta Perseus, is an example of what they do so well. These songs have sort of a suite-like progression. They're not traditional verse-chorus type of pop song. They start off with low-key beauty in that song, almost hymn-like, and then it builds into this really weirdly dark terrain, and then back to the acoustic stuff. You know, it takes you on that journey. Go Dig My Grave. My God, what a journey that song is. It's just chilling the way they perform that song. So I think they're doing some amazing things with traditional elements and taking it into a futuristic avant-garde realm. I just love what this band is doing.
I wish this was a two-song EP. I'll stand by that, the opening track, the closing track. But that's what we think of the new albums by Wednesday and Lancome. As always, we want to hear from you. Share your opinions via a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org, so we can play it on the show. Coming up next, we'll talk with Janet and Rick of 11th Dream Day on Sound Opinions. Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island has been brewing award-winning beers in Chicago that are inspired by this city. Take 312 Lemonade Shandy, Tropical Beer Hug Double IPA, and a rotating series of hazy IPAs only available in Chicago. You know, every time we go down to Goose Island, there's another one that they're pushing on us.
That's right.
They're all good.
Absolutely. And what supporters of musical culture, you know, in the city of Chicago and elsewhere, if you go to a show in Chicago and you see that Goose Island sign, you know you're in good hands. They're music fans as well as great beer makers at Goose Island. So we're really proud to be associated with them.
The Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer.
Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find IPAs, Lemonade Shandy, and limited releases in-store or at one of Goose's venues in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer.
And we're back. 11th Dream Day has been a mainstay of the Chicago music scene for 40 years now. And like our recent guests, Poster Children, they've been through many ups and downs over the years, including signing to a major label in the late 80s.
The result was similar for 11th Dream Day as it was for Poster Children. They didn't sell a million records, so the major labels lost interest. Of course, that has never affected your fandom of these guys, Greg. I love how much you love them. I can't even compete. I just merely adore them. You worship them. 11th Dream Day is playing an all-too-rare gig on April 29th at the Metro in Chicago, and band founders Rick Rizzo and Janet Bean are excited to have their son, Matthew Beveridge Bean Rizzo, opening up for them. So we took this occasion to talk with Rick and Janet about the group's long history. It's not just a Chicago thing. I think they belong to America.
Oh, absolutely. They're one of those bands that, to me, transcended their time and continued to make great music to this day. You know, I started out our conversation by asking Janet, the group's drummer and vocalist on many of their songs, about what first brought the band together in Louisville, Kentucky 40 years ago.
The band didn't really start in Louisville. The relationship that Rick and I have started in Louisville, because I lived there, and there was this punk rock house. It was called 1069, and art school students and different bands all kind of hung there. And I was just getting out of a rehearsal that I had with a band I was in at the time called the Zoo Directors with Tara Key and Tim Harris of Antietam. And Rick was in the living room, and he looked really cute, and then I kind of got smitten on him. And then I moved to Chicago, and then we sort of started the band in Chicago.
What was that scene like? I mean, I was in there in the scene, but I want to hear your perspective in terms of, you know, I was going to shows. You guys were playing shows, getting together, starting to play clubs. What was the scene like for you? Was it hospitable? Did you find it, like, really
this is mid-'80s?
Welcoming? Yeah, mid-'80s, right?
You know, I felt like a total outsider because I had been in school in Lexington, Kentucky during my punk formative years. So all the bands like Big Black and Naked Ray Gun and, you know, the bands of the time from Chicago, we were not part of that scene because we weren't here. We did our punk rock time in Kentucky. So when we started playing here, I mean, I didn't feel like there was any scene that we were a part of. So we were kind of forging new ground. And we didn't really sound like those bands in a lot of ways. I think we had a lot of the same punk roots. But that said, the city was highly hospitable to us. You know, I think college radio, WNUR specifically, really latched onto us off of a demo tape that we had circulating through Rick Menk's hands.
He was in the Reverbs at that point, right?
I don't even know if they had formed yet. But,
I think they were.
I remember seeing Big Black, I think before I met Janet, I was at a loft party where Big Black played. And it's funny because Metro is also having their 40th anniversary.
Yeah.
So I was going to shows there. You know, I saw the first REM show there. You know, kind of grew up together with them. But we were doing shows. I think our very first show was in Lexington, Kentucky in January of 1984. But we formed in the fall of 83, hence our 40th anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
We quickly found friends in the scene, but we never really connected with that original Chicago punk group.
Hey, Rick, what year was that when we played that Armadillo Days?
That was spring of 1984.
And, yeah, so I remember.
Armadillo Day was a WNUR Northwestern production in a giant field outside, and we found ourselves on the main stage.
Yeah, and
you know,
I think
on a beautiful spring day.
Urge Overkill were playing, not on the main stage, somewhere. I remember that was like the cool show to be at, and we were on the main stage. And this is when we it was just Rick and I, and the bass player was Shu Shubat. One of the ways that you could tell how different we were musically is I remember us covering Creedence that day, Who'll Stop the Rain. So I don't think Urge was covering that at that point. They did go on to do some covers.
Yeah. We also did Revolution Blues.
We did Revolution Blues.
Neil Young.
Oh, yeah.
I wandered over toward Urge's show. I saw Urge's show, and Steve Albini was right in front of the stage setting off tons of firecrackers. Cool kids were over there. We were on the main stage with the Hacky Sackers out in front in the field.
Down the mountainside to the coastline, past the angry tide, the mighty so wise.
I didn't really catch up with you guys live until I started seeing you had already had a batch of original songs. So when did the songwriting process start? Because you mentioned the covers of Neil Young and Creedence, and obviously that's in your sound to an extent back then especially. When did the songwriting come along?
I had already been writing a little bit. I was in a punk band in Lexington called The Pods, a three-piece kind of power punk trio. But on bass, I had a hard time writing. So I taught myself how to play guitar, and I started writing a little bit. Kind of embarrassing to listen back, kind of crappy, derivative stuff. I think my favorite band at the time was probably like Joy Division, Mission of Burma, but very brooding young man kind of stuff.
Echo and the Bunnymen, yeah.
Mm. Echo and the Bunnymen, yeah, just post-punk British stuff in Mission to Burma and the Feelies a little bit. But I didn't have the chops at all. But I had a lot of energy back then.
Rick played a teardrop vox that was very red and very, very cute. And the way that I remember Rick telling me how he recorded his first demos, because he had some when he was living in Ithaca, New York, prior to me meeting him. And what was the setup, Rick? It was like you had to record something on, you know, a regular old-fashioned recorder, and then...
In my college dorm with my roommate, we rigged up my tape player to be an amplifier. We were both into Tangerine Dream and making ambient noise. So my bass playing, I did have the Who songbook and was trying to learn from Quadrophenia. That didn't work out so well, but I did figure out that you could put a lot of distortion on the bass and use various things as slides and making whale noises. And Tangerine Dream was a... you know, what we were shooting for. So it's I'd love to hear that tape. But, you know, back then you had to rig things to make them into amps. And
some of that Tangerine Dream stuff started filtering in a little later, I think, too.
Yeah.
Interesting. But, you know, when I saw you, Baird Figge was already in the band. Doug McComb was already in the band, which kind of rounded out that lineup. Shu was the original bass player. And I'm not quite sure why she left. Baird and Doug were there, and that's the lineup I remember, and it was a ferocious two-guitar, full-on thing. It was you and Baird going back and forth, and Doug kind of holding it down, and Janet, this roller coaster thing you were doing on the drums was just so exciting. It was this thrill
you
ride,
never
a minute
knew what
kind
tempo.
Of deal.
Well, you know, I think it's the greatest thing about that era of music, the indie bands back then. I mean, we were like a lot of them. We barely knew how to play. We were all new to our instruments. Doug was brand new pretty much to bass playing. And Baird always said, he'd always do these licks. And he'd say, when I learn this lick, I'm moving to Nashville. Well, he never moved to Nashville. and we made a racket and kind of learned together, which I think, it explains some of the evolution of our records. You know, if you go back to those early ones, they're kind of messy.
Yeah, but in a joyful way. I mean, seeing the group.
That's why we're still a band, is the joy.
Yeah, I remember seeing you out in New Jersey, New York, where I was growing up. I can't remember if it was Maxwell's or Folk City when Ira Kaplan was booking it, or maybe CBGB. I don't know. And it was like, but I'd seen already Naked Raygun and the Effigies and Big Black on their first trips out east. And it was like, I just went, you know, every Friday and Saturday, whatever was happening in Maxwell's. And it was like, this doesn't sound like Chicago, but this is great. So I know what you were saying about not fitting in. You were paving your own way, but ahead of your time. I mean, you know, now we're one of the alt country, for lack of a better term, capitals of the USA. Weren't no such thing in the mid-80s, but you were paving the way for that, what would become a very vibrant scene.
Well, Free Quarter was in the mid-80s, so we were beginning that process.
Mm-hmm. Wild and blue, it's no
we all listened to country music, you know, like old country, and we'd actually run into Langford and Company downtown watching the Sundowners, you know, so we all loved all that stuff. It, you know, there's a total punk rock feel to Hank Williams and, you know, I think it's where we had
Carter
the
family.
Spirit.
Yeah.
You know, and the thing that kind of impressed me was the, you know, Perry School Freakout, 1988, the first full-length album. That had that guitar thing down, and what impressed me, too, was the songwriting. The songs, there was craft in the songs, but then there was total chaos in the way, you know, the music sounded in a very thrilling way. I don't mean that as a put down at all. To me, what Jim was getting at, I think, was that that record wasn't appreciated in its time because it was probably like 3 or 4 years ahead of its time. Those kind of bands were getting snapped up by all the labels, you know, in like 92, 93 with that kind of sound. And you guys had that early on in like 88. What was it like, you know, that record, Prairie School Freakout, I highly recommend anybody, if you want, hey, let me check this band out. Let's start there. That record was recorded in like less than a day, right? I mean, I heard various stories, 24 hours or 6 hours, something along those lines, right? Like it was basically a live record in the studio, right?
Oh, yeah.
We started early evening and ended about 2 or 3 in the morning. We kind of hit a wall around midnight. And then Janet just started getting on her, you know, come on, you guys. And it was like, let's keep going. And I'm glad because we ended up doing a bunch of covers and 10th Leaving Train, which was one kind of an epic long song of back then. And that I think that was the last one we did. And you could just hear the end of that song just grind to this exhausted, ecstatic halt.
I recall regarding the interplay between the two of you, I think I was there for some of the recording of that Beat album, and Janet was giving you a hard time, Rick, about you need to really step it up here. Let's get some screaming. Let's get some noise, man. What are you doing here? You're holding back on me. Let's go.
We needed Rick Rizzo to be Rick Rizzo right then. We needed him to give it his all.
It's funny because I went on tour with Smog, and we were doing this European tour. And I was just trying to find my place in the band of you know, not trying to be out front too much. And there was one show where Bill just came over and whispered to me and he said, be Rick Rizzo. And it's like, I had to process what that meant, but it took about 5 seconds. And I was, oh, okay, I think I know what to do. And I stomped on something.
Yeah. More noise.
It's kind of like... We had Bob Mould in the studio a few times, and it was interesting when he started playing guitar, there would be this look on his face, like you could tell he was being transported. He was not of this earth anymore. It was just kind of this almost cosmic kind of look, and that's a Rick Rizzo look too. Like when you're playing that guitar and sort of getting lost in it is a fun place to see. But it's interesting that sometimes Janet has to prod you to get there.
A well-timed drumstick throw can jostle one. But yeah, you know, it's like I was kind of conscious of the fact that I was always able to reach a point at some point in a concert where I felt like I lost myself. Sometimes it would be from the opening chords. Sometimes it took, you know, if we were on tour playing every night for, you know, 2 months, sometimes it took a little longer to get to that. But I was happy that I was always able to avow that if that never happened, if it stopped happening, I would just, you know, there was no point. To me, that was the point of it, to get to that spot.
Right around this era, that to Atlantic Records' credit, they asked a young A&R person, Bettina Richards, to start finding bands. Let's find some of this new stuff. She signed you guys and Lemonheads, I think, right around the same period of time. And that experience was less than stellar. Atlantic Records didn't know what to do with independent music, but they knew that they had to sign some of it to try to figure out the market.
Got to stay in the game, yeah.
But you put out 3 albums on Atlantic, which, you know, is a place where a lot of bands never got. And that was unique in Chicago at the time because you preceded, again, the wave of big signings and all that stuff. You were one of the first bands of that era to get signed to a major. What was that experience like? I mean, it's probably hard to summarize it, but I'm curious. You have the hindsight of a few decades now. Would you have done it again if you had an opportunity?
I would do it again. While it wasn't commercial success for us, we got to do all kinds of things that we wouldn't have been able to do otherwise, and travel around the world and not only make, you know, have support, financial support to do it. And we met Bettina, we met some great people, Regina Jaska, people that worked there that were great. And in some ways, I think, you know, just going through that experience, it made us sort of stronger as a unit when we came out of it. You know, it wasn't like, oh, we didn't make it, we're not a success. It was sort of like, how are we going to make our next record? It's not on Atlantic. We got another record. So I think it made us, I don't know if it was more determined, but it didn't fluster us, really. Me, anyway. I can't speak to Rick, but it was just like, sort of an exciting diversion off our path just for a little while that made it interesting. It was fine.
I had no idea why they were interested in us. I mean, Bettina, we were pretty raw, and I did not associate that word with major labels so much. I mean, Hooskers and Replacements had signed their deals, and they were raw too, but what do you see in us? I didn't get it, but at the same time, we had a record out on New Rose in Europe, and we were talking to Rough Trade at the time because Amoeba Records, which was not the store, but a tiny label run by our friend Keith, you know, we felt like we had kind of outgrown that as he was a one-man operation out of his house. And so we were talking to labels, but indie labels, you know, that totally took us by surprise. And back to Jan said, I have zero regrets about doing it that way. We did give up some things, some of the things that were advantages of being an indie band back then in terms of touring.
Being able to sell your records at a show. We weren't allowed to do that on Atlantic.
Really?
When we toured with Yola Tengo in Europe, you know, all we could sell was T-shirts. They could sell, like, all their records. And we had to, like, rely on these distributors to have our records out at the stores, and they weren't hitting the small indie stores where we had built the following. Mm-hmm. But you know, every band has that was on a major label in that era has their stories of how they were done dirty and wrong. It's like, sure, but I would change nothing. I'm really happy with the records we did. I don't think we ever compromised ourselves.
Coming up next, Rick and Janet explain how they kept going after the major label era ended. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions. Remember in 2018 when Border Patrol separated thousands of refugee kids from their parents, deported those parents back to their home countries, and kept the kids in the United States? Believe it or not, 6 years later, there are still hundreds of families who have not yet been reunited.
Though we as a community may feel hopeless at times, we recently learned about an organization called Al Otro Lado, which works to reunify families. They provide holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in the U.S. and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice.
Since 2018, they've reunited over 100 refugee families ripped apart by the zero-tolerance policy of the previous administration. Once reunited, Al Otro Lado helps each family find legal representation, housing, and the counseling they need in order to heal and get back on their feet.
Imagine having your child ripped from your arms and never knowing when you would see them again. We can't let family separations go on. If you're like us and believe that all families belong together, then join us supporting Al Otro Lado and donate today.
You can find the link to donate to Al Otro Lado in the description of this episode, or go to gum.fm/charity and donate today. That's gum.fm/charity.
You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities that are both in person and virtual. The best way to get involved is by filling out an application on their website, elotrolado.org/volunteer.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And we are back. We're talking with Janet Bean and Rick Rizzo of 11th Dream Day. We were just talking about the period just after they were dropped by Atlantic Records.
Rick, when I first saw 11th Dream Day and in the early days, you know, it was always about the two guitars to me, as much as Television was, as much as my favorite East Coast band, Dump Truck, was. And then there's a point where Baird Feige is not in the band anymore. What was that like, losing his presence?
Since Tom Verlaine died recently, I've done a bit of a dive. I don't even have to do a deep dive because I've never not had a deep dive into Television. But I was listening to some stuff, and then I'm rehearsing on my own for our show. It was like, oh, yeah, I got that from television. I got that from television. Baird got that from television. And realized, like, you know, there was always one of the bands that we were, you know, if the long list of Gun Club, X, Television, Neil Young, you know, everybody was influenced by the Velvets. Television was, I realized that that was such an important influence in a lot of ways. And me and Doug and Baird. I mean, I also have discovered in rehearsing a little bit that I can never play like Richard Lloyd, but I can channel Verlaine a little bit. He doesn't play as fast. Baird was the one that could do the runs. I was the one that could bend notes a little bit. First of all, we were just fans of music. And I think, you know, like the common thread of bands of that era, just television was a giant influence.
The two guitar thing was incredible. And, you know, I know that Baird had to leave because of the family situation he was in. Touring can be tough on people with families, for sure. You know, I'm interested in that record. After the Atlantic thing ended, El Mudio was the last record, put out a great single that should have been a lot more popular than it was, and then the band got dropped, and you guys made that Ursa Major record, which, to my mind, I was talking with somebody else about this the other day, that's one of my favorite, if not my favorite, record now in some ways. It's just such a, it was a departure from what you'd done earlier, and I thought, Rick, I don't want to read too much into Orange Moon, but that seems to me like your commentary on your feelings at the time of what had just happened to the band.
I have to say, there's a resemblance between the image of the Orange Moon and the Urge Overkill orange, you know, the things people used to stick on their car antennas for
and
the
they signed to Geffen
storms.
They had all this product and yeah, it was like
they
the
had
7-11,
they had that swag of, they had their UO thing that they put on their car antennas.
Mm-hmm,
so
right.
I without getting too deep into it, they have obviously had taken over the world and,
for 2 minutes.
And I had decided that I was going to leave no chance of taking over the world, and that's when I went back to school to be a teacher. So I guess I was kind of pining over the idea of not being a full-time rock musician. So you'd have to listen to the song, listeners, if you want to go back and try to dig into that. I gave the one clue.
The sky, you know, is for sale by the chunk.
I think that's my favorite record too, really. It's I don't know what it is. I love Blindside. I love that song. There's a whole different feel to those records. There's less of an anxiousness, I think, to them a little bit.
I think after Baird left, I mean, Baird had a real rootsy sound. You know, we did have that alt country that I think came from Jan and I. Baird also a little bit in that, but he also had a far bluesier background. And I think we lost some of that when he left, because I started writing more, and Janet still wrote her fair share too. But I think Ursa Major just reflects this real diversity of our sound.
Mm-hmm.
You get some hints of Tortoise in there in 1994, and you get some of the country. I think it just really runs the gamut in terms of our style, which I think sometimes bands that have a real similar sound, a real cohesive sound, makes it easier on the listener. We just had a lot of things in our heads at the time, you know, writing softer songs.
Mm-hmm.
I think Yola Tengo went through the same kind of process of wanting to explore other sides of the band. You know, I guess we had a little of that on El Mudio too with Honey Slide, but it was just the time and the place led to some real different sounds from us, and that's when Wink left the band too.
Wink O'Bannon, who had replaced Baird, yeah.
He was having a hard time being in Louisville and us being in Chicago, and we were never as poor as we were as when we were on Atlantic Records. We didn't have a lot of money back then. I was working at a distributor and Rainbow, the Rainbow Club in Chicago. We'd You know, we were broke after Atlantic kind of cleaned us up. We only got tour support. That's what kept us floating on Atlantic.
So you make this record, you know, kind of a little bit of a left turn, which was fantastic. You had to be at a crossroads then. I think a lot of bands at that point would have said, okay, we had our shot. And Orange Moon hints at it a little bit, like, okay, we had our shot. It didn't happen, whatever. And they would have quit. You know, they would have stopped. Obviously, that didn't happen with 11th Dream Day. You've continued to make records. I don't think there was ever a point where you said, oh, we're done. It just sort of kept going. But on a more manageable scale, instead of doing national tours, you did handfuls of shows at a time and put out records when the time was right. But you managed to keep it together since then. I'm just curious about that time, what the mindset was. Did you think, Rick, after... and Janet, after Ursa Major came out, that this was going to continue? Because obviously, Janet, you had Freakwater, which mm-hmm. presaged the whole, you know, alt-country thing. You know, you were a Bloodshot band before Bloodshot existed, you know? If
yeah.
And Doug had the thing with Tortoise, which became like the sensation of the European press in particular. The whole post-rock thing got hung on Tortoise as the founding foundation of that whole
Peter Margasak wrote about him every other week in the reading.
So it could have very easily ended at that point, and I'm just curious as to your feelings about whether the band was going to continue or not at that point.
I think something that's fairly consistent for me with both Freakwater and 11th Dream Day is that there never really was a plan. There was not a goal or a plan, and so since we never failed at meeting our goals, since we had none, there was no reason not to continue. Just like saying we're done would have required an action and a decision. And I think it was just an absolute reluctance to make any decisions and just keep doing it. There was no reason not to. And we weren't a regular, like, weekly rehearsing band at that point. And I miss that, you know, thinking now, it's like, I wish I just went to practice once a week or something. I don't think we just thought about it. There was no reason not to do it. I don't know. What do you think, Rick?
Well, Freakwater and Tortoise just, they ascended so quickly. I mean, Tortoise alone, like, helped create this post-rock movement, which was gigantic. And Freakwater also was, you know, you guys were doing shows, these giant shows and tours, and I was just going to school and staying home with the baby. But I was still writing, and, yeah, you know, part of me felt like kind of crappy to stop like that. But I was still writing songs. What really kind of sparked me was I was working in the mailroom at Drag City, and so every project that came up there, it seemed like I got to play on. You know, I did a tour, like in 97, I did a tour with Will Oldham, Palace tour, I did the Edith Frost record, you know, I was, you know, sitting next to Sean O'Hagan. I was playing bass on that. Like, I just had to rethink who I was and what I was doing. And so that kind of caught my breath at that point. But to this day, really, like, you know, since El Moodia, we haven't been a regularly working band. We don't rehearse unless something's coming up, and, you know, to Doug and Janet, it's like, I got this group of songs, do you want to try to record? So that's really how it's gone for the past 20 some years.
Without digging into unduly personal things, you saw this guy on the living room couch a million years ago and you thought he was cute. You wind up as a couple, and then you wind up not as a couple. We all know that to sustain a band for decades, four of them now, in your case, is difficult, right? People change and people grow and people have new interests. You've sustained the band and managed to be friends despite ending a marriage.
Yeah, I'm pretty proud of that. And at times, it wasn't easy. We had to stay connected, obviously, Rick and I, because we had a son together and a son that had special needs. And so that sort of maintained this constant relationship. And then it wasn't like you could say who gets the band and the divorce or anything, you know.
Right.
We just kept going. And I'm sure, you know, it was very painful for both of us at different points, but we just kept on doing it. And I feel that we sort of worked through something, you know, we got through that hard point and things got easier and better. But it wasn't easy, and I have to certainly give props to Doug, because we were pretty much just a three-piece at that point, because he just he didn't let it get to him. Whatever was transpiring, he kind of went along for the ride and didn't say this is really messed up. But you know, we weren't like actively fighting with each other in the band. It was much more subtle. I think, you know, Rick had his ringtone for me at the time was what was that ringtone, Rick? Something about the Brat.
Beat on the Brat by the Ramones.
Yeah.
And Doug has always been like, you know, we the three of us just have something very organic and great. We understand each other. We have never not had fun. And we get these little, you know, we've had the fourth member for a long time. It was rotating. I think Ira was the first person that helped us out on a tour. And then Tara Key and Tim Rutili, Jim Becker. Like, we've had a lot of people step up. And then Mark Greenberg came aboard when we were playing shows for a Stalled Parade, which was right around the junction of where we could have broken up, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Mark injected a lot of fun, Mark of the Cocktails fame, mm-hmm. And Archer Pruitt fame. And then when Jim Elkington came on board in 2010 with a tour, he's injected, that brought the second guitar back and really brought some sparks, I think, that really defined the last couple of records we've made.
That was a big boost, I think, just in terms of the sound and the energy in the band. It had to be. And Rick, you tried to make a solo record in 2021, 2020, somewhere in that area, which became Since Grazed, which became an 11th Dream Day record, because you couldn't, what is it, because you can't live without these guys, right? Or something like that.
I had songs kicking around for so long, and I just was frustrated. I didn't know what to do, and I told Janet, it was like, because Doug and Jim were so busy, and Mark's always busy. I'm just going to record. And I asked Mark, because Mark is a force behind the Wilco's The Loft. And I said, Mark, can I come in one night and just use some really good mics? And I'm just going to use my acoustic guitar and sing. And he said, sure. So I had a dozen or so songs. And I asked Janet to come and to try to give me some, you know, just observation, just another set of ears to help give me some ideas of how to move forward. And after a couple of songs, they both, Mark was, after the first one, he's like, yeah, that's an 11th Dream Day song. And then every song, like Janet would pipe in, I think that's an 11th Dream Day song. Because I was like, these guys, these aren't even 11th Dream Day songs. You know, like, just, I'm just going to record these, you know, and get some people to play on it. Maybe I'll ask you guys. But by the end of that session, I had everything tracked with vocals and acoustic guitar and with the plan to make an 11th Dream Day record.
I'm feeling so blessed. I needed the rest. I've lately repressed, but the tones are unfazed.
It's been a remarkable run, and it's not, you know, 40 years, and who knows, it could be another 40 for all we know, right?
Or a memorial.
What would you tell a band today that's starting out and say, how'd you guys do it? How do you stay together for 40 years?
I can't pretend to know how to proceed as a band these days, because just for one thing, the sheer number of them is overwhelming. I don't know half the bands at the bottom half of a Lollapalooza lineup, or even Pitchfork for that matter. But what one thing that I do tell young bands is that element of a scene, that element of camaraderie with other bands. And our anniversary mirrors that of really of Antietam and Yola Tengo, of bands those are two other bands that have been around as long as we have, and have enjoyed making music together as long as we have. And that kinship, you know, when we were coming up in Chicago, we had a lot of friends that we enjoyed seeing. It was not competitive, but to grow together, it's not a race to the top for anybody. But my advice is that to find like-minded people, you know, and so like if you know somebody that does film, work with them, do something with them.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody that does theater, work with them. Just like-minded artists. That's the beauty of being in the music industry.
Well, it's a different definition of success, isn't it?
Right.
It's not, not making money. It's experiencing the joy of community and loving what you're doing with each other, and then doing it for people that you also wind up with lifelong friends.
Right. And I think people go into being in a band for different reasons. And I don't think one is not better than the other. There are plenty of bands that started because somebody wanted to be a rock star, and that's some of the best music we have out there, because somebody in that band wanted to be a rock star, and they made it, and they made great music in the process. And then there are other bands that don't, you know, I started playing music, I think primarily because I wanted a family, not because I wanted to be a rock star. I didn't see it as a way to earn riches. I wanted a community and a family, and that is why I love it so much. And I suppose I keep going back for Thanksgiving dinner to the family, you know. It's just a family, and that's what it's brought me. A family all around the world, and we have a great time in this automatic connection of music, and it has made my human experience so much richer, and that's what I love about it.
Mm. We've been talking to Rick Rizzo and Janet Bean, 11th Dream Day, the founders of a band that is now 40 years into a remarkable career. It's great to have you guys on the show again. Thank you.
Thank you.
I really appreciate y'all having us on again. And you know, I think we go back to your anniversary.
That's true. That wraps up our conversation with Rick Rizzo and Janet Bean of 11th Dream Day. And now we want to hear from you. Leave us a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org, with your thoughts on this band or anything we talk about on the show. Mr. Cott, what is on Sound Opinions next week?
Next week, Jim, a terrific documentary on Jimmy Carter, the rock and roll president, let's face it, right? We talk with the director of that documentary, and do not forget to check out our bonus podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts.
The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors. Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, and our associate producer, Sol Delgadillo. Our Columbia College intern is Lauren Holt, and our social media consultant is Katie Cott.